On these summer Sunday evenings, we have been addressing various issues faced by Christians in 1987. And so I knew several months ago that the topic for this evening would be facing the issue of AIDS. I begin by sharing some personal words that, in preparation for this study, I have read and examined all kinds of articles and books and research, so much so that I think those that are around me during the week at coffee breaks and things like that are rather weary of my quoting all the things that have been read, and I find myself somewhat overwhelmed by the statistics and the information and the volume of all of the details that can be considered, and a frustration that comes with all of that in the brief amount of time to share some of that with you this evening. But I think that most of all, I have personally experienced a combination of being shocked and of being sobered, of being frightened, of being saddened. And I have found that while I thought I knew some about it, that it is really quite astounding, that we are in the beginning stages of what virtually everyone who writes about it calls a modern plague. That already millions of people, millions, have been affected. And predictions promise that within the next 5 to 10 years, virtually everyone who is here tonight and everyone whom we know will know someone who has contracted AIDS and in all probability who has died of AIDS. Now, of course, the medical community can only theorize about some things, like how it began and where it began. There are those who say that it seems as if AIDS began somewhere in Central Africa and has been transported from there to elsewhere. There are a multitude of theories unconfirmed about a lot of dimensions, but one point where there is not theory but knowledge is for those who have contracted AIDS that the death rate is 100%, that everyone who gets the disease dies of the disease. The medical statistics and information are overwhelming, and with it, the spiritual and the ethical consideration. It's hard for me to know where to begin. I do not, of course, claim to be any type of an expert, although I have read the experts. And I have, after considering all these things, frankly, very few, if any, final conclusions. And I think that it may be too early for just about anybody to come up with final conclusions, yet as Christians and as a pastor, I'm convinced that we must address what is fast becoming the issue in our society in the conclusion of the 20th century. Well, what I would like to do with our time tonight is divide our consideration into three parts, the first of which is some medical background, the second, some current statistics, and the third, at least a preliminary look at what might be our Christian response. In terms of medical background, I don't feel at all adequate in trying in my own words to describe to anyone what AIDS is or how it is defined. I have graciously been provided some publications from the Mayo Clinic, and if you'll allow me, I'm going to read to you a few pages or parts of a few pages of the literature that is provided through the Mayo Clinic to those who have AIDS and to members of their family. And with the confidence of the accuracy of the Mayo Clinic community, then I feel better with their words than mine. The first of the questions, of course, is what is AIDS? The term AIDS refers to the A, acquired, I, immune, D, deficiency, S, syndrome, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The Centers for Disease Control defines a case of AIDS as a person with an opportunistic infection, that is, infection that can just run rampant in one's body, or Kaposi's sarcoma, which indicates a deficiency in the immune system for which there is no other cause. By the way, Kaposi's sarcoma is a relatively rare form of cancer that up until recent years was primarily, if not exclusively, seen in elderly people, and one of the things that became disturbing to the medical community is that there were so many instances of this hitherto older person's disease seen in young homosexual males. But the definition goes on. Normally, the immune system continually produces cells and antibodies that attack infectious agents that otherwise cause illness. It is the body's defense system. AIDS lowers the body's immunity, allowing various infections and tumors to occur. AIDS has now become a major public health problem in the United States and certain foreign countries. We'll learn in a moment far more than the number that we might guess of foreign countries. Another question is, what causes AIDS? AIDS is caused by a virus known as the H, human, T for T cell, L, lymphotrophic, V, virus, type 3, or as it's abbreviated, HTLV-3. As the name indicates, the virus infects the helper T cells, a type of white blood cell. These cells are important for the proper regulation and functioning of the immune system. The HTLV-3 virus enters the helper T cells, multiplies, and may destroy the cell. As a result, the immune system functions inadequately. Now, skipping again a lot of the information that they have given, we'll move on to yet another question. What is an HTLV-3 carrier? For you see, the medical community has defined that there are the majority of people who do not have the virus. Then there are those who have the virus that are carriers. Then there are those who have what is called AIDS-related complex, or ARC, and then those who have full-blown AIDS. What is an HTLV carrier? A carrier is a person who has been infected with the HTLV-3 virus, and the virus is maintained in his or her blood. A carrier is often healthy, with no symptoms. However, body secretions and blood may contain the virus and be contagious to others through intimate contact. Next question. What is the AIDS-related complex? The term AIDS-related complex, ARC or ARC, refers to symptoms that may occur in a person infected with the HTLV-3 virus, but who does not meet the criteria for AIDS, that is, an opportunistic infection or Kaposi sarcoma. These symptoms may include fever, weight loss, night sweats, fatigue, enlarged lymph nodes, and persistent diarrhea. Unexplained enlarged lymph nodes in several areas of the body for over 3 months may be an indication then of the disease. These symptoms are thought to be caused in some way by the HTLV virus. Some people with ARC or ARC may develop an opportunistic infection or Kaposi sarcoma, and then they are classified as having AIDS. How is this virus, HTLV-3, transmitted? HTLV-3 is primarily transmitted through intimate sexual contact or direct injection of infectious blood into the bloodstream of another person. HTLV-3 also has been transmitted from a mother to her child during pregnancy or delivery. Activities that have been shown to transmit the HTLV-3 virus include rectal sexual intercourse, vaginal sexual intercourse, or oral genital sex, needle sharing during drug abuse, or transfusion of infectious blood and blood products. The virus may possibly be transmitted through other body secretions coming in contact with mucous membranes. There is no evidence that AIDS is transmitted by casual or indirect contact, such as talking, handshaking, touching doorknobs, using public bathrooms, or eating in restaurants. The tests now used for screening blood donors for HTLV-3 should markedly decrease the risk of people receiving transfusions. And then the last of the questions from this lengthy pamphlet that I'll read raises the question of how contagious is AIDS? And the answer is that AIDS is not a highly contagious infectious disease, but requires direct intimate contact with blood or infectious secretions for transmission to occur. We know that the HTLV-3 virus is not as contagious as common childhood diseases. For instance, HTLV-3 is not transmitted through the air like chickenpox or influenza, and not by contact with inanimate objects such as doorknobs or toilet seats. The HTLV-3 virus is fairly easy to kill and does not appear to live long outside the body. People who live with a person who has AIDS or is an HTLV-3 carrier have not been shown to be at increased risk for acquiring AIDS if there is no intimate sexual contact or sharing of unsterilized hypodermic needles. Now, that's the official answer in relatively layperson's terms from one of the major research and treatment centers in our country. But there's some other things that I would like us to note in relationship to the medical background. One of which is that there is at least a measure of difference of opinion in the medical community. So there are some who increasingly are seeking a broader definition of AIDS than that which the Centers for Disease Control currently use. Now, a rather narrow definition having to do with opportunistic infections and Kaposi's sarcoma, and that pretty much it. There are others who would say that AIDS directly affects the mind and causes dementia, and that that ought to be included in the definition of AIDS. So there are differences of opinion, and that's to be understood in what is a relatively new phenomenon. That means, though, that if anything, the statistics that we hear, that we read, are clearly on the conservative side, because the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, are using an amazingly conservative definition. And that means, of course, that there may, in fact, could well be more people who have the disease. By their definition, up to 3 million people in the United States may be carriers of the virus. And most of those people don't know that they're carriers of the virus because they have no symptoms. Although, even though they have no symptoms, they are able to pass the virus on to other people. The time from when someone gets the virus to when someone shows symptoms, if they are going to develop ARC or full-blown AIDS, can range upwards to 5 years, and some would say maybe even 20 years. Now that becomes astounding, because that means then that there could be millions of people who in fact will get AIDS and will die of AIDS, who will be unaware of the fact that they are even carriers of the virus for 5 to 20 years, and during that period of time could of course infect many, many other people. One of the interesting things is that AIDS then becomes very different from other plagues that have been problems throughout history, because in most cases the plagues of ancient times and even plagues in relatively modern times have had hasty symptoms. That means that people have quickly broken out with fever or with pox or with other things that would quickly identify them as having the disease, and so historically often those people with the diseases have been isolated. But when someone doesn't show any symptoms for 5 to 20 years, of course it's difficult, if not impossible, to determine who those people are, and it's likely then that they not be isolated. That long dormant period of time then of course makes accurate statistics difficult, but it makes spread very easy. Another note in relationship to the medical background is, of course, that there is no cure. And that also is frightening, that everyone who develops full-blown AIDS dies, 100% mortality. 51% of all of the reported cases of AIDS in the United States have already died. The 2-year mortality rate is 70 to 90%. And the 5-year mortality rate is 95 to 100%. The average person from time of diagnosis of AIDS to death lives a period of approximately 18 months. Will there be a cure? Well, if you listen to the news as I do, there's always a note of hope that is offered, just as there has often been a note of hope offered by the medical community for anyone who has any terminal illness. We all think in terms of there being a breakthrough, of being a cure that will save our lives. The reality is, though, that there apparently is no foreseeable breakthrough. There is no immediate likelihood of a vaccine being developed which would prevent someone from getting AIDS, and even a lesser likelihood of any type of medical treatment which would cure AIDS. That makes the future for anyone with the virus, and certainly anyone with AIDS, extraordinarily bleak. Well, from that medical background, let's take a look at a second item, and that is some current statistics. Beginning with the number of people in the United States who have been documented to have the disease as of the 1st of June, 1987, figures that come from the Centers for Disease Control and which they acknowledge are probably at least 20% underreported. The number of AIDS patients, victims, as of June 1 in the United States include 35,554 adults, 504 children, for a total of 36,058 people, of whom 58%, or 20,849, have already died. the number who have been infected with the virus, the CDC estimates at 1.5 to 2 million. The state of Minnesota has 222 cases of record. Of those 222, 89% are in the category of homosexual, bisexual males. Of those 222 cases, 49% are in the age bracket of age 30 to 39, for AIDS has become a disease of the young. Of the 222 reported cases in Minnesota, 57%, or 129, are from the city of Minneapolis. 13%, or 29 cases, from St. Paul. 41 cases, or 19%, from the rest of the 7-county metro area. And then another 25 cases, or 11%, from the rest of Minnesota. That means, of course, that 89% of the documented cases of AIDS are in the 7-county metro area where we live. That's the United States. A lot has been said about Africa, and particularly Central Africa, 5 to 10 degrees north and south of the equator. The number of documented cases in Africa is 4,000, far fewer. Although, because of the nature of medicine and reporting and other cultural factors in Africa, those who are part of the World Health Organization and other institutions who evaluate these things clearly indicate that that is an extraordinarily small number in comparison to the realities. That the estimates are that probably there are at least 50,000 actual cases of AIDS in Africa, mostly in Central Africa, and an estimated 5 to 7 million people who are infected with the virus, and probably that also is a conservative estimate. Last weekend, when I was away at another conference, one of the people who shared a bit of testimony is a lady who was a Christian and Missionary Alliance missionary in the country of Zaire, which is Central Africa. She talked about the extreme frequency of AIDS in the area where she ministers and explained some of the reasons why. She said, for example, in the areas from which she comes, that hypodermic needles are routinely reused without any type of sterilization simply because there's nothing else available. And so all types of injections are given to one person after another using the same needle. In the same area, she says that oftentimes there are emergency cases where the only way to save someone's life is with an immediate blood transfusion, and the only thing that can be done is to determine if the person is of the same type of blood. There is no way to do screening for the AIDS virus, and so if someone has the disease, then it is passed along through blood transfusion, and if it weren't done, the person in all probability would die right away. Add to that that others say that the culture of many of the African countries for thousands of years has included facial and other body types of tattoos. We think of that when we think of Africa, where tribal markings are put on a person's face, but again, often that is done with needles that are repeatedly used with different persons, all of which create a system of hygienic difficulties that are allowing for the transfer of AIDS in a multiplied way in Africa. Add to that long traditions of heterosexual promiscuity. Put all those things together, and Africa really is the boom place for the transmission and the multiplication of the disease. From the USA to Africa to worldwide, well, it's reported that there are 51,535 AIDS cases around the world. 112 countries have actually reported cases, 28 of them with 100 cases or more. It is estimated by the World Health Organization that there are probably more than 100 cases already of AIDS and 5 to 10 million people infected with the virus. I don't know what you do with all of that. In some ways, 50,000 or 100,000 doesn't seem like a whole lot when you realize that the population of the world is reaching near the 5 billion mark. So in terms of percentage, it is extraordinarily small. What becomes sobering and frightening and saddening is when you begin to see what the implications are in projections for the future, including the projections of the health workers. The CDC projections for the United States alone are that by 1991 there will have been 270,000 cases of AIDS and 179,000 deaths. In the year of 1991 alone, let's just understand where we are. We are more than halfway through 1987. So if you figure about a half year of 1987 left, and then all of 1988, and all of 1989, and all of 1990, January 1 of 1991 is less than 3.5 years away. In that year of 1991, the CDC projects that there will be 54,000 cases of AIDS, the full-blown disease. That compares to the estimate in that year of 45,800 deaths by motor vehicle accidents, saying then that more people, significantly more people, will die of AIDS in 1991, less than 3.5 years away for the beginning of that year, than in motor vehicle accidents. That 145,000 people in 1991 will be treated for AIDS, and the medical cost for doing that will be somewhere between $8 and $16 billion. The projections have been worked out by the CDC for all of the decades for a number of years ahead, but I give you just one other, and that's for the year 2000, so 10 years after the 1991 date. By then, 7 to 10 million people with the virus, 1 to 1.5 million with the actual disease, 1.5 million people with AIDS, and 600,000 to 900,000 deaths by the year 2000. You take that out in the projections for the whole world by the year 2000, it means 100 million people with the virus. Now, of course, the saddest and most difficult part of it has to do with the people who actually have the disease, but there are other implications as well, including the costs. In the United States, in 1986, $1.1 billion was spent on medical costs, a half billion on research and education and screening, $7 billion on lost wages from disability and from death. But go again, the year beginning less than 3.5 years from now, into 1991, and see how it escalates. In 1991, $8.5 billion on medical care only for those with AIDS. $2.3 billion on research and education and screening, and $55.6 billion in lost wages from disability and screening. Some more statistics. The population distribution, that is those classifications of people who have the disease. 74% are homosexual, bisexual men. 17% are intravenous drug users. 4% are heterosexual contacts. 2% transfusion recipients. 1% hemophilia coagulation disorder patients. And 3% is uncharacterized, or no one knows how those people got the disease. Geographic distribution, well, in the United States, there have been documented AIDS cases in all 50 states, so there is no place to where one may escape. Most of the cases, though, have been in large urban areas, and the reason is that those high-risk groups are more numerous in those urban areas. The top states in terms of the incidence of AIDS include New York with 31.7% of the AIDS victims, and California with 22.1%. That means that more than half of the people in the United States with AIDS are either in New York or California, which may give you a certain level of comfort being in Minnesota, about as far away as you can get from either place, except the trends are that the disease is moving from the coasts and inland. Of the top 10 states, they are New York, California, Florida, Texas, New Jersey, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. having 1.8% of all of the AIDS cases, but Washington, D.C., of course, being proportionally much, much smaller than these other major population areas. Some other things on considering current statistics. Understand that these are based only upon present trends, so that if the disease were somehow to move into the general population, or if it could be spread in other ways, or if the number of people infected with the virus is significantly underestimated, then we would see an extraordinary escalation of the people who would be involved with it. The impact on the medical system is potentially overwhelming. We currently have in the United States 1,360,000 hospital beds. And if you're part of the medical community, you know that the hospital bed population in terms of percentage in most hospitals has been declining to the point where it's somewhere, I think, around 76%. That means, then, that about 1 million of the 1,360,000 hospital beds in the United States are typically occupied. leaving 360,000 unoccupied hospital beds. But when you start to put that up against the number of the AIDS patients projected for the 1990s and the year 2000 and after, that means then that there are more people with AIDS than there are hospital beds available to treat those people with AIDS. Add to that the potential impact on health insurance companies, on employers, on Medicare, on Medicaid, and it is potentially disastrous. In addition, we are seeing at least the beginning of what may be profound societal changes as a result of AIDS. You know that already this has occurred in sexual practices in the country, where there is a new call for celibacy and for fidelity within the bounds of marriage. There's a great deal of talk about safe sex. And so people are very, very concerned, and already at the very beginning, the morals of the country may be changed, not for moral reasons, but out of fear of contracting the disease. Social changes have already begun to shift in discrimination against certain high-risk groups, particularly homosexuals. There are changes already beginning to occur in the law requiring testing and in the law requiring discrimination in hiring. Interestingly, a lot of people have gone back in history to study plagues and to find out how the population has responded to the Black Plague or to yellow fever epidemics in other places and in other times. One of the conclusions is that populations turn to extreme behavior in times of plague, behavior that is uncharacteristic of the way the society had previously operated, and it could at least be projected that we are not exempt, that our society is also capable of extreme behavior in a time of the outbreak of plague. Well, you take the medical information, the statistics, and there's far, far, far more than that. What ought to be our Christian response? How do we handle it? What do we say? What do we think? What do we do? A physician named David Scheidermayer has an article in The Current, the August 7th issue of Christianity Today, in which he talks about choices in plague time. He says that historically, there have been three choices available to people in times of plague. Those choices are desertion, persecution, and compassion. Desertion, in the Middle Ages, many people simply moved out of cities where there was plague, particularly those who were wealthy. And so plagues became the diseases of the poor. Particularly in plague times in Middle Ages, the physicians and the pastors left the cities to preserve their own lives. In 1665, in the city of London, most of the wealthy and most of the physicians left the city. The population of London was then 400,000. 70,000 of them died. Eventually, the population was reduced to 200,000 people in London, and there were 13 doctors who stayed to take care of 200,000 people. One of the consequences of all this was that as doctors left, as pastors left, as the wealthy left, as those who were healthier left, there came a virtual breakdown in society because there were such tremendous losses in the structures of society. So desertion is one of the alternatives. And I mean, I hear that from people frequently. If there's AIDS in New York City, get out of New York City. If there's AIDS in your area and you might get the disease from other people, move as far away as you possibly can so at least you preserve your own skin and your own life. So desertion is one of the options in times of plague. A second option is persecution. During the Black Plague in the Middle Ages, the people, Christians, blamed it on the Jews, said that the Jews were infecting the air and were contaminating wells. And so people severely persecuted Jews, saying that they were the ones who caused the trouble. In the city of Milan in 1630, there were two men who were accused of spreading the plague. One was a barber surgeon, and the other was the commissioner of health. It was said that they had some deadly ointment that infected people, and they spread it around. So the Senate of the city of Milan met and condemned these men. And here's what they wrote. The Senate decreed that their flesh should be torn with red-hot pincers, their right hands cut off, their bones broken, and that they'd be put on the wheel for 6 hours and then burnt at the stake. You see, you have to find someone to blame when all the fabric of society starts coming apart. And we well know that even at the beginning of what may be the worst plague of all, that even in our country, there has been persecution against people who have the disease or are thought to spread the disease. Of course, the third choice is compassion. And there have been those throughout history who have had compassion. Pope Clement VI, who was at a place called Avignon in France during a split in the Catholic Church papacy, gave his personal protection to Jews because they were being blamed for the plague. The King of Poland, King Casimir the Great, offered all of Poland as a sanctuary to Jews so that they wouldn't be killed in the rest of Europe because they were blamed for the plague. In 1793, there was a plague in the United States. It was in the city of Philadelphia. It was yellow fever, and people were fleeing. Physicians, for the most part, and leading citizens left the city. One man, a man named Dr. Benjamin Rush, out of Christian commitment, said that he would stay and that he would take care of the victims of the disease. His choice was compassion. One of the questions that we must face, I must face, is the question, why? Why is this awful disease here and now? There are some, perhaps including some of us, who say that what AIDS is really all about is God's judgment upon homosexuals for a sin that God blatantly, very forcefully condemns. I want you to take a look at the scriptural basis for this accusation. It's found in Romans 1, verses 26 and 27, a pair of verses that really are, in a sense, being torn from the context of the chapter, although the chapter is a familiar one to many Bible students. It speaks of homosexual practices and says, beginning in Romans 1:26, that for this reason God gave them up to dishonorable passions, gave up on them. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. Now, on one hand, that makes sense. You read Romans 1:27, receiving the due penalty for their error. And you hear about AIDS, which is 74% homosexual and bisexual men, and it seems a logical conclusion to say, aha, that is God's punishment for that disease. And not only that, but because it is a terminal disease, that will then eradicate those who are practicing that disease. And there is a logic to that. But there's also a difficulty with that when you either experience firsthand or hear secondhand the stories of children who are born with AIDS because the child's mother was in an automobile accident 2 years earlier and had a transfusion through which she got the virus. Or other people who are part of the medical community who, through exposure to contaminated blood, either through a piercing with a needle or through spilling on an open wound themselves, have gotten the virus. And we begin to wonder if that, in fact, is a fair thing to say, that they then are the victims of God's judgment upon other people. They are the innocent victims of this terrible disease. C. Everett Koop, the Surgeon General of the United States and an avowedly committed Christian, tells us that the enemy is the disease, not the people who have the disease. Now, I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer of whether or not this is a judgment from God. I think that that's possible, and yet I struggle with that. I wonder if perhaps it could be a divine judgment in one sense and that there are innocent victims as well. But I'm not sure that our response depends upon whether or not it's a divine judgment. I'm not sure it has anything to do with it at all. For don't we know as Christians that we must condemn sin, and specifically the sin of homosexual acts, but also have compassion upon those who are the victims even of their own sins? I think of Jesus, you do as well, who touched and loved and spent time with those that the rest of society would have nothing to do with the outcasts, even with those who had the awful disease of leprosy. And has not leprosy been replaced by AIDS, and the AIDS victims are our modern lepers? Jesus said, as often recorded in the Gospels, but here quoted from Mark 12, 30 and 31, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." I'm not sure that we often think of it this way, but perhaps AIDS in our generation and in our society may be our greatest opportunity to obey this commandment of Jesus, to love our neighbors as ourselves. Compassion. That's not easy. It's not easy to love those who are unlovely. It's risky to show compassion towards those, recognizing that we may put ourselves and those who are members of our family and community at risk. I think we're all frightened. I think we're more prone to desert or to persecute than to have compassion or help, and I don't pretend that I know how I would behave in extreme circumstances. And yet again, what greater opportunity could we as Christians have in our generation to demonstrate the love and the person and the compassion of Jesus Christ and to do it for those who are victims of this terrible disease? I want to read to you another story, and I hope you'll bear with me in reading what I think is a moving tale of what one church did. It's the story of the Episcopal Church of St. Thomas the Apostle in Dallas, Texas. Our ministry to those with AIDS walked through the door one day in 1984 when Jerome, a 32-year-old man, came into my office and asked if I would bury him, says Ted Karf, rector of the Episcopal Church of St. Thomas the Apostle in Dallas, Texas. He explained that he had AIDS and that three churches had refused his request. Jerome soon found himself immersed in a community that loved and accepted him, giving him hope and taking away his desire to kill himself, which, unbeknownst to Karf, was what he had planned for the weekend when he met that Episcopal rector. 20 people from the congregation organized themselves to take care of Jerome, cooking, cleaning, and shopping, as well as praying and sharing his emotional ups and downs. But trouble loomed ahead. As the news media gave greater coverage to the AIDS crisis, several in the congregation began to fear that they might catch the disease from Jerome. The first issue that emerged was the communion chalice, says Karf. People would nervously ask, "Are we in danger?" Karf called the CDC in Atlanta. They told him that though the virus had been found in saliva, there had been no reported incidents of contagion through sharing utensils or plates or communion cups. In fact, Jerome was the one with the most to fear. Because his immune system was so weak, someone's flu could translate into deadly pneumonia for him. It was Jerome who was risking his life every Sunday, says Karf, not the others. By midsummer 1985, fear of AIDS was breaking out across the U.S. "This time, people wanted me to ask Jerome to leave," Karf says. "Then they wanted anybody in the congregation who was gay or in one of the high-risk groups to leave." Karf said, "No." By the end of the summer, two-thirds of St. Thomas's 150 members had left. Karf, however, was not bitter. He said, I did understand their fears. With his congregation down to 50 members, and with the church income down by two-thirds, Karf had his moments of doubt. My wife asked me, "Are you sure you know what you're doing?" I answered, "No, I'm not sure. All I know is a man asks us to keep faith with him. How can I tell him no?" The church had to start over. They made a public statement that those with AIDS were welcome, and they came. This was not easy for the members who stayed. They had to work through their feelings, said Karf. Jerome helped them in the process. He had said to us, "Don't judge me. I'm living under my own judgment. What I need is for you to walk with me as much as you can." Because the congregation kept faith with him, Jerome came to faith. Not because it was demanded of him, explains Karf, but because people went the distance with him. They had risked a lot. Jerome's last day in church was the day the church was reconstituted and he became an official member. As the church was coming out of its ashes, Jerome was there with a 106-degree fever, Karf remembers, wheezing and gasping for breath. 38 days later, Jerome was dead, and the church grieved, not only for Jerome, but also for the parish as they knew it. Everything about the church had changed. Today, 200 people worship at St. Thomas the Apostle. It has also become a center from which ministry to people with AIDS flows, with six organizations operating from there. Karf also helped create the Dallas AIDS Interfaith Network, which now includes 80 clergy from different denominations. The Reverend Scott Allen, a Southern Baptist minister, heads the network. Every Sunday, three or four people with different aspects of the disease worship and partake of the sacraments at St. Thomas. They will soon join the 30 from the congregation who have died of AIDS in the last 12 months. These deaths take their toll on the church and on Karf, but they have seen the mercy and the grace of God as they have never seen it before, says Karf. We've got a covenant to keep, to love our neighbors as ourselves. Do you think Wooddale Church could do that? I don't know. I couldn't even know if God would give us such an opportunity. But I hope that our answer would be in response to Jesus Christ and what he calls us to, not in response to our fears or our prejudices. Well, those who came tonight hoping for a final word are going to leave with disappointment, because I have no final word. I think the best I've got is a preliminary word. A preliminary word that we renew our commitment to Jesus Christ, no matter what. You see, it's easy to commit when the stakes are low. It's hard to commit when the stakes are high. That we declare our conviction that the soul of a homosexual or the soul of an AIDS victim has eternal value to God and therefore eternal value to us as well. And that we represent Jesus Christ, for we are his body and we are his agents, that we represent him in condemning sin but always in showing compassion for the victims of sin, even if they have brought the consequences of that sin upon themselves. That we love the Lord our God with all our souls, with all our hearts, with all our minds, with all our strength, and that we love our neighbors as ourselves. Let's pray.